Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Welcome back to Right on Four Corners. I'm your host, Elsherie Gladden. I'm a USA Today bestselling author. And on this week's episode, I have C.W. Smith, and he is going to be talking about his novel, Girl Flea Circus. C.W., go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm a retired professor of creative writing from SMU. I was there for 32 years. And this is my 10th novel, my 13th published book. I've been writing about the Southwest pretty much all my adult life because when I grew up in Hobbs, New Mexico, I never encountered any literature in high school that spoke to me because it was all 19th century English literature. Not that there's anything wrong with learning that, but it never dawned on me that a literature could be made out of the people that you ran into in everyday life. And when I went to college at North Texas, University of North Texas now, I suddenly was introduced to John Steinbeck and Faulkner, and I suddenly understood that some of the people that I had been living among in Hobbs during all those years I was growing up there were people who were worthy of being depicted in fiction. So this is probably the third or fourth book that I've set literally in that border of New Mexico. Other books have spread out in greater areas of the Southwest. So I feel very at home with writing that kind of material, both historically and then also contemporary. I have several contemporary novels that have also been set either in Dallas or in Texas or in New Mexico. I'm pleased to be here talking with you, and I'm very happy that you have chosen my book to highlight and to discuss.
I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun with this. Growing up, I never really read historical fiction, which is funny because I loved history and I loved learning about other places and cultures, but it just, for whatever reason, wasn't a genre that I ended up getting involved with until I made a friend through a writing group or something, and she was writing historical fiction. And I loved it so much that it sparked an interest in me for reading historical fiction, and it is one of my favorite genres to read now. So it was really nice to be able to not only read historical fiction, but something set in this area. I grew up in northern New Mexico, but it's such a fun, unique, interesting part of the country. And I agree, seeing those kind of everyday people in stories where you can relate and really make those connections, for me, I think is a lot of fun. And I think a lot of readers as well will probably connect with that.
Well, of course, you were lucky you got to grow up in northern New Mexico, because all my life I've met people in the east or in the west in California, and they say, "Where are you from?" I'll say, "From New Mexico." They say, "Oh, I love Santa Fe. I love Albuquerque." So, well, yes, I do too, but unfortunately, my part of the state is like West Texas.
It's a state of varied climates and locations. It's such an interesting place. You don't have to go very far to feel like you've gone somewhere completely new. So tell me about the inspiration for this story. I read just a little bit in your website and your interest with it being loosely based on a story with Amelia Earhart. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that and how you got interested in female aviators in this time period and turned that into your own unique story.
When I was about 12, someone told me that Amelia Earhart had once, you know, made an emergency landing in our town. And when I found out that, you know, shortly thereafter that it was in the 20s, I could easily imagine that the town at that time probably only had one street. And so apparently created quite a stir, according to the legend. And that's exactly what I thought it was, a legend. I couldn't imagine, because she was so famous in my mind as a kid even, couldn't match up my little anonymous town with someone of that kind of celebrityhood. So it just sat in my head for, I don't know, half a century at least. At one point, I decided I was going to try to track the story down, and it turned out to be very easy because that transcon little trip that she was on was very highly publicized, and every little newspaper in the country sort of tracked her every motion as she left from the Westchester County, New York airport. And so I read the biographies of her, I read her own memoirs, and she wrote a lot. She was actually the aviation editor of Cosmopolitan magazine. At the time that she made this landing in Hobbs, 3 months prior to that, she had become known as the first woman pilot to cross the Atlantic. And I know that conjures up images of Lindbergh and his trip the previous year, but actually she was one of three people in the cockpit, and she was one of two pilots, and there was a navigator. So it wasn't a solo flight, but it instantly elevated her visibility nationally. And so when she made this trip, it was there. After I started studying her life, I realized that she was surrounded by a whole coterie of other women flyers who were not, probably because they didn't die trying to circumnavigate the globe, they didn't become as famous. And I sort of became interested in them. And after I read several other biographies and delved into that, I felt that they were equally worthy of attention. And I didn't really want to write a fictionalized biography of Amelia Earhart. I ran across a photo of Phoebe Amalie, who's another one of those young flyers who competed in that race of 1929. And her face, she looked like a 12-year-old to me in her helmet. And so it just suddenly struck me that I wanted a young female flyer in my story who sort of repeated the same action that Amelia Earhart had done and every other pilot had done. Every pilot who flew had to land someplace every day because they couldn't fly at night, so they were always making these kinds of impromptu, non-scheduled, semi-emergency landings wherever they could find a place to put down. That's what I wound up with, was a fictionalized representation of a young woman of that era who could have done that.
It's always so interesting to see where the inspiration for something comes from. And I think that's really neat that you pulled from so many sources after having kind of that childhood story that first got you interested and made you wonder. And then really, it sounds like kind of spawned a greater investigation into a part of history probably a lot of people don't know about, of these pioneer women pilots in the early first part of the 19th century who were out doing some pretty amazing things.
Yeah, they really were. I mean, we have these two big movements in our literature. One is person goes on a journey, which is the case of the pilot. But there was also, there's the stranger comes to town, which is the way I got the story as a kid, imagining myself in that town and Amelia Earhart coming in out of nowhere where no plane had ever been before and suddenly landing on the main street in town, what kind of effect it might have on the people. So that was another reason why I didn't want to over-focus on the flyer in the novel. So that's why there's so much attention to all the other persons, people in the town, and the characters who are there to receive her and to bounce off of her and to react among themselves about her.
And that was something about the story that I really enjoyed. There's a fairly large cast of characters, and you go into their lives in different ways and show kind of the personal journeys that they're on as this pilot, Katie Burke, quite literally, falls into their lives and disrupts quite a bit. And it was fun to see, especially with a couple of the characters like Mabel and Leonard, who seemed a little bit stuck in their lives and kind of needed something to jolt them into action. And all of a sudden, this amazing incident happens where this young female pilot has come into their town and everybody's, stirred up a bit by that. And I wanted to ask you how you approached developing some of these. I wouldn't even call them side characters because I felt like they were as much the part of the story as Katie, but how you developed some of those backgrounds and their arcs as you were writing.
It's very evolutionary in the sense that my novels, anyway, go through six or seven drafts, and with each draft, more is added in my mind, more facets to their character, and I began to, I don't know, I suppose it's both intuitive and also deliberate to try to think about what's going on in their life that will be affected by what has happened. It was only about 3 months ago that I realized the first sentence and the last sentence of the book really bookend the kind of theme that runs through the whole novel of self-actualization. I think the first sentence is something like, young A. Beatrix's brand new moniker was Skippy Baker. So she'd given herself a new name in the first sentence of the novel. And the last sentence is, I am a citizen of the air. So the idea of somehow finding your place, finding your identity, finding where you are meant to be, working toward that. Can't say it was there right from the start, but as of about draft four, I began to think, all these people are struggling to become or to change in their lives in some way. And it's interesting that you mentioned Maple and Leonard, because they are the only two characters who leave. They're stuck, but they leave. I was also very aware of having grown up in Hobbs, which was a oil boom town, not at the time, but too long out of the boom when we moved there, that I didn't know anybody there who was actually from there. Was there anyone who's actually from there? Everybody who I knew or lived there had come there from somewhere else, usually because of oil companies. And so that was true of No Name, is that it has no tradition. It has no identification which colors their identities. So they are in a state of open possibility for self-creation. This is all, I don't know how much I had worked this out. It sounded as if I had it all planned out, but I didn't. It was just so, as the novel grew and it changed and it went through many drafts, I began to understand how each character was struggling with his or her own conflicts and problems, and how having this other stuff happen around them was going to propel them forward.
Yeah, and I think that that is such an interesting perspective, thinking about No Name and its history and how that impacted the characters. It sounds like drawing from some of your real life experiences, but how important setting can be in a lot of stories. Not necessarily every story, that's not always a major focus, but I think especially things that are set in small towns, the history, the culture, the idea of what that town is really does shape the people who live there, and it influences their experience and their perspective on the world. And in a lot of cases in the book, No Name feels like kind of a little island out by itself. And you kind of forget as a reader that more exists outside of them.
I deliberately created a place which has no history, no tradition. That's why it's called No Name. I mean, it's called No Name because the cartographer wrote that down as a placeholder name. But symbolic of the way the town has no precedence in it that will force them to do one thing or another. And I think that the extent to which they are able to bounce off of one another, so not having that behind them, they draw into one another. And so they form this sort of large, loosely connected unit that you might call a family of some kind. They all rely on each other. And it's the thing that gets Katie the most when she has to leave. In the very end of the book, when she's remembering flying over those small towns with her father in the mail delivery aircraft, that she looks down on those small towns and she imagines now that they're not just, you know, blank houses, spaces, that there are people in them and they have a bond, they have a community, they have relationships that she suddenly realizes that was missing in her life, and she still doesn't have it. But before, she was sort of convinced that they were just beneath her, literally beneath her and socially beneath her, in the sense that she was part of this circus group, that everybody else were rubes, they were all outsiders. But really, they had a strong bond. Those people in that town had a strong bond that she had never known. I think that's the thing that she realizes the most. And it's because the town has nothing but the people in it that they are forced to rely on one another.
I liked that perspective of her coming from somewhere bigger and seemingly more adventurous, and she's off doing these unusual things for a young woman in her time period at her age. You get that dual perspective again of her coming in and experiencing something completely different than what she was used to, and really finding some value in that. And for so many of the townspeople who, what they knew was small town living, scraping by, you know, trying to make things, the everyday parts of life, a little bit more interesting. And that interruption in their life pushed a lot of the characters to step back and think, is this what I want? What has been going on in my life up to this point. How did I get here?
I think that's particularly true of Leonard and Louise. They are the ones who are really, well, and Mabel as well, but Mabel has been on the verge of leaving for a long time. But Leonard didn't know that he was going to be leaving until, she came and all this erupted. And it's the same thing of Louise. It wasn't until she went to the hospital that she regained her sense of what it had meant to be a nurse and to be among a community of nurses and doctors and to have companionship and fellowship of fellow workers and fellow professionals. It wasn't until that happened that she was really pushed to do what she does at the end of the book. We're talking about the development of characters and the discoveries. I remember when the first night that Mabel and Katie share a bed and they're talking about their backgrounds, I really started being aware of just how sort of feral Katie was, that there was so much about normal, ordinary life that she did not know. She never had the experiences that Mabel describes having as a high school girl among high school girls. And she suddenly realized Katie's a little bit like a kid whose parents don't care if they get any schooling. She's very outside the norm, and it's not particularly in a good way altogether. And of course, Mabel tries to defend her whenever she's talking in the salon, and some of the ladies talk about how about school and how about church and how could you live without those things living in this circus atmosphere? And this Mabel tries to say, in effect, well, she didn't know what, we expect children to know, but she knows a lot of other things that they don't ever get to know. So there was this always this tension in my idea about her. To what extent was she different from everybody else? To what extent was she the same?
That was an interesting comparison. That was one of my favorite sections of the book, was that relationship that starts to grow between Katie and Mabel, because it really did highlight the differences in where they came from and how that affected them and how it affected what they wanted out of life. That really created so many layers to the characters that I really found fascinating, and I enjoyed seeing Katie's layers especially unfold as more of her history came to light and as she was learning to become more open and then in some ways forced to become more open when people started discovering a few holes in her story.
Exactly. One of the questions that comes up really quickly usually is that is Mabel a lesbian? And I have to explain it by saying that my best friend up until 4 years ago when she died, outside of my marriage, was a lesbian married to a woman and she lived two doors down from me. And she was very open about her sexual evolution. And she was talking about how she got married and she had a straight marriage as a young woman, had a son. And it took her years to understand where she really was in that spectrum of sexuality. And it's about the same time, a very close member of my family, a woman who was married for 17 years to a man and had three children, suddenly told us one day, she said, well, I'm getting a divorce because I fell in love with a woman. I said, okay, so are you a lesbian? Well, no, I just fell in love with a woman. So then, a year goes by and they break up and she falls in love with another woman. And finally, she said, well, look, I've just fallen in love with a woman again, and all three of these women have been lesbians, so I guess I'm a lesbian. So the whole point being that Mabel would not know to use that word, but Katie awakens this, which has been under the surface for years. And so I think when she gets to Los Angeles and you learn that she's living with another school teacher and they take trips on the school teacher's motorcycle and you're thinking, well, okay, I see now what she found when she finally went there. She finally decided this is going to be my life. And of course, in those days, two women school teachers could live together for decades and nobody would ever openly accuse them. They would just whisper about them. And I mean, a single woman, a woman without a husband, needed financial support and moral support. And it'd be very, very natural to think of them living together. I didn't start out the novel thinking that's where that was going to go with that, quote, old maid school teacher. She's kind of a fixture of Western stories. The school teacher who comes from the East, it's a kind of cliche. And so I tried to take that cliche and build it from the inside out.
I think you did that really well. She was really interesting. She comes from this polite society, and you really developed that tension in her of not only did she want to stay, was there something bigger for her? Are there more adventures out there? But I did find that fascinating because, like you said, that wouldn't necessarily be the term. That wouldn't be something in the 1920s that she could openly discuss with other people trying to understand her own sexuality. But meeting Katie and having those experiences, it was like, maybe there are other options. Something right, that probably yeah. really hadn't occurred to her as an adult, that she had other options other than be an old maid or eventually find a husband.
Yeah, there wasn't a very large available pool for any kind of partner for her. And she's very lonely, and she misses that intimacy she had with her friend Elizabeth in high school. And she missed that before she even came out there. She was completely out of her element when she first came there. But she feels more at home now because she's found a role to play in the community. And she's, as a school teacher, she has a kind of blank check of respect to start out with. So that's what's kept her, but it's not been enough.
Yeah. And on the other side with Leonard as well, he has also not many options. It's a very small town. And he develops this crush on Mabel. And from what he's seen growing up, that would be enough to say, okay, let's get married. And it was interesting to see as Phillips' crush on Katie and then the nurse in the hospital where he's just like, oh no, like I'm just full of, you know, all these lusty feelings. And it's like,
yeah, I'm totally baffled by myself.
Yeah. And it was just, it made me chuckle a little bit, but it also made me like feel a little bad for him. I'm like, oh, yeah. Like this yeah. is so normal. Like you yeah. need to
well, I'll
go experience.
I want to reassure you that, you know, he did go to California to go to electronics school. Then he writes back to Wally that he's been studying radar. And I was thinking, well, now when the war broke out, he's probably deep into that. And he would have gone into research and development of, say, onboard ship radar and that kind of thing all throughout the war. And after the war, he might have started an electronics hobby shop. He'd have a wife and five kids. So I have a really good life plotted out for him that goes way beyond the book. So rest assured that, you know, even though he's baffled in that hospital scene, he does eventually find his way.
That's good. He was just a cute character. I really just adored his character. And
this is one of those books where I wanted everybody to have a little bit of what they really wanted and needed, which is what you can really expect from life, I think, if you're lucky. And I wanted that for them. I think that's maybe reflected in the tone of the book. I think about Leonard. I didn't know what he was going to, once again, about the evolution of the characters. I only knew he was a kind of young, lovelorn guy who's, you know, looking around for a maid and having all these feelings. And I had no idea that he was going to be sort of the ambassador to the future. And he was going to be someone who has one step in the old agrarian West and one foot in modernity. Came about, first of all, when I built a crystal set radio when I was a kid, and I wondered, maybe he'd like to have a crystal set radio because radio was real big. The government was trying to get people to build crystal set radios in the 1920s. So if I Googled crystal set radios 1920, and there was a brochure that the government sent out to anyone who inquired about how to build one. Leonard runs across this in the back of a magazine that he stumbles onto, and he sends off for it, and he gets it. And not only is it described how to do it, but every part that's needed is available in the 1928 Montgomery Ward catalog, which they all have there passing around all the time. And, of course, I was able to get, in 5 minutes, via Google, the whole catalog, every picture intact, a complete reproduction of it. I thought, well, yeah, you know, that's where his bicycle comes from, and so in the end, when he realizes that there's this whole world of electronics that's just happening all around him, he just feels like he's just got to, that's what he wants to do and where he wants to go. And it has nothing to do with livestock. He hates livestock. Poor Mabel keeps thinking that he likes books about cowboys, so she keeps giving him these Hardy Boy stories about cowboys. The evolution of the characters happened a lot by way of just fumbling around and thinking about who that character might be at that time. Another aspect of it is just the historical thrust of him being on the edge of Martina. This town has no electricity. It has no running water. And it's when he hears that music coming through the air on his crystal set radio gives him this sort of immediate sense of the outside world, of the world that lies out there. That this music is coming from, you know, WPAV in Fort Worth. So he's just completely bedazzled by the idea of this world out there, this suddenly come to him through these earphones of these bots. Otis and Wally are refugees, you might say, from a colony of all black merchants and farmers and blacksmiths and bankers and such that was established. It's a place I call New Jordan in the book, but it's an actual place that was called Blackdom, and it's west of Roswell, about 15 miles. In 1908, a black preacher came out there to try to found this colony, which in the advertising in the Eastern newspapers, it is free from Jim Crow laws, it says. So he got a pretty sizable group to come out and help him plat the town, actually. And it was thriving pretty well during the early 20s. But eventually, drought and insects completely ruined the cotton, and they were unable to keep the land from going alkaline, and so it just sort of withered away. Wally and Otis had come there from Texas, where anti-miscegenation laws had prevented them even from seeing one another in socially, and they'd gone out there to enjoy this freedom, and when it collapsed, they went to No Name. Because it has no tradition, no history, it is no place. They felt they would be free to be, not quite anonymous, but they would be free to be recognized for what they might be able to offer the community, which was considerable. And of course, ironically, they're the ones who benefit from the boom, in that their business in the cafe starts overwhelming their usual practices and routines, and they have to add a dining room, and they have to add help, and they have to add another meal to the daily menu and so forth. And then Otis buys the land out there and buys the old shack and wants to move out there into a real place, because almost everybody in the story does not live in a real place. They live in kind of ad hoc dwelling. And that was also part of the ahistoricity of the story, you could say.
I think it goes back to that theme you mentioned of finding a place to fit in society and in your own sense of self. And that was, I think, a really interesting theme to pair with what starts out seemingly as just like this adventure. And I really enjoyed those two coming together, that deeper sense of who we are and where we fit in the world and how that intersects with some of the surprising things that happen in life.
One thing I worried about, of course, was this is a biracial relationship. Is the reader going to accept it as credible? I don't know why it came about that they were that, but I knew they were an older couple. They're both in their 60s. And they both have a history behind them that we don't know the details about, but we can sense the weight of it. I didn't feel like I really needed to explore it, because the place itself, they were trying to escape whatever sense of history was source of oppression for them, both personally and socially. The extent to which they are able to make a new life together, make a new identity together, was more important to me than anything else.
I did just want to remind readers that the title of the book is Girl Flea Circus, and that's by C.W. Smith. And where can they find the book and you to stay up to date on new projects that you have coming out?
My website is cwsmiththeauthor.com. And Amazon carries not only that book, but all of my other books as well. This book can be found from the University of New Mexico Press, Barnes & Noble, and other online booksellers. I really appreciate your appreciation of the book. It's clearly you did, and I enjoyed your questions. They were very, very excellent questions to try to respond to. So thank you very much.
I really appreciate you taking the time, and I definitely would love to hear about your next project when you have it ready and have you come back on. I think that'd be great.
Thank you. I will do that.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.